conquest of the self by Brother John.
My dear brothers and sisters, we come this morning, as our chairman has pointed out, to the great battle of Beth Horon and the warfare which followed that resulted in the conquest of the whole of the southern part of the land as it fell before the invading Israelites. So this morning we're all going to go off together to join Joshua and the soldiers of Israel in the warfare of Christ. So I hope everyone's got their sword sharpened up, and I hope everyone is feeling rich in faith. And bear in mind the fact that Deuteronomy 20 provides that any who are faint-hearted have got to go home. So we don't want you to sit down there, Brian. So we don't want anyone faint-hearted this morning. We want to be away to the battle, and we want to be rich in faith, and we want to see the reward that comes to the people of Yahweh when they walk before him in faithfulness. As we saw at the conclusion of our study yesterday morning, Adonai Zedek, King of Jerusalem, summoned Confederate kings from the south that they might join together to go out to war to defend this vital part of Beth Horon, which is a point of the hands of the Israelites, with open the whole of the south and this is Selah and the plain right up to the invaders. They had to be prevented. But as well as that, they were feeling extremely niggardly at the way in which the Gideonites had turned against them. So it was going to be a twofold warfare. It was going to be to gain possession of the path of Beth Horon, and it was going to be to administer justice upon the faithless Gideonites. And so the call went out, and in verse 4 we read, "Come up unto me, and help me, that we may smite Gideon, for it hath made peace with Joshua and with the children of Israel." So the five kings we read, therefore the five kings of the Amorites, the king of Jerusalem, the king of Hebron, the king of Jarmah, the king of Lachish, the king of Eglon, gathered themselves together and went up, they and all their hosts, and encamped before Gideon and made war against it. So what that really means is that the strategy had been decided upon. They knew exactly how they would pursue this war. They were not foolish in their attempt to dislodge the Gideonites and gain possession of that vital and strategic area. They went up and they encamped before Gideon and they made war. The strategy had been decided upon. And then they attacked in earnest the strongholds of the Gideonites. Well, this, of course, brought an immediate result. Verse 6. And the men of Gideon sent unto Joshua to the camp at Gilgal. Now remember, the Israelites were now their only friends. And they sent a message to Joshua which constituted one word. Help! Well, actually, it was probably a little more involved in that. They probably sent a message to him that said something like, "Hop on your bicycle and get up here as fast as you can because we're in real trouble." And probably, "P.S. don't stop for morning tea." Well, that, of course, would have put me off immediately. Nevertheless, the call went out, and they were in dire straits. And the Gideonites point out that they are under attack. "Come quickly, save us and help us, for all the kings of the Amorites that dwell in the mountains are gathered together against us." Notice the way in which that is set out there. That is the message that Joshua received. You see, in the flurry of instant battle, the Gibeonites would not at that point have had the opportunity to sort out exactly who was fighting them. So the narrative is basically very, very informative. They wouldn't have known exactly who were there, but what they did know was that the kings of the Amorites from the mountains had become confederate against them. And so in verse 7 we read, "So Joshua ascended from Gilgal, he and all the people of war with him, and all the mighty men of valor." Now although he is much chagrined at the deception of the Gibeonites, Joshua honours the covenant. You see, they've made a covenant and they're going to stand by it. But not only is Joshua prepared to honour that covenant, but it would also be swiftly apparent to him as a military strategist exactly what the strategy of those Confederate nations was. He would realize the urgency of the situation. And he would appreciate that the path of Beth Horon had to be won for Israel, and that these Confederate kings were not simply concerned with warring against Gideon, but of holding that vital strategic area and thus impeding the progress of the Israelites through the land. So he brought up with him all the people of war. The Jerusalem Bible renders it, "bringing all the fighting men and all the bravest of his army with him."
So they knew that it was to be an earnest battle. And they knew that they would have to fight with great courage and faith to overcome these difficult circumstances. And in verse 8, he receives an exhortation from Yahweh. Yahweh said unto Joshua, "Fear them not." Very interesting words. A repetition of what Joshua had been told in the very beginning, chapter 1 and verse 9. At the very beginning of his mission, he had received these words of encouragement from Yahweh. "Fear them not." Now here is a great confederacy of nations with great power raised against Israel. But Yahweh says to him, "Fear them not." You see, absolute faith in Yahweh and in his ability to save is the keynote for a successful warfare of faith. You see, it's not enough merely to believe in Yahweh. It is necessary to have absolute faith in him and in his ability to save. And if you haven't got that conviction, then you are a dead loss for the warfare of faith. Those are absolute prerequisites for a successful warfare. And so Joshua, very quickly summarizing the situation, receiving words of encouragement from Yahweh, set forth with his army to the battle. And it says in verse 9 that Joshua therefore came unto them suddenly. But again, we present the Jerusalem Bible translation of that verse. It says this: "Having marched from Gilgal throughout the night, Joshua caught them unawares." And that is precisely what that verse is telling us. Having marched from Gilgal throughout the night, Joshua caught them unawares. And I want you to appreciate this, that 17 miles separated the army. Well, you might say to me, "So what? But you've got a whole motor car parked out there." These fellows had to go on foot in the darkness of night and over some of the most rugged and forbidding terrain you could ever wish to have to follow. The circumstances were extremely difficult. But these men were men of faith, and therefore they were undeterred. They marched right through the night. A difficulty that would no doubt bring them a great deal of exhaustion, but the next morning they were ready to fight. That's the point. You see, in effect, these were not people who were too tired to go to the meeting. These were not people who couldn't keep awake during the meeting, because they were dedicated to a cause and they were motivated by that. And that is very necessary in life and the truth. Remember what Paul says in the 2nd of Timothy chapter 2 and verse 3. He says, "Endure hardness as soldiers of Christ." And you know as well as I do that a soldier doesn't dictate 9 to 5 hours. If a battle rages for 30 hours in the field, that soldier must be prepared to fight until a decision is made. Soldiers don't lay down the law to their leaders as to when they are going to fight and when they are not. Imagine a general saying to the troops, "Well, men, we rise and attack at 4:30 the next morning." And one fellow pipes up and says, "But excuse me, sir, my mother always taught me never to get up before 7. And of course, I always expect a cup of tea in bed in the morning." What sort of a response would that get? You know what sort of a response it would get. Now you see, these men were prepared for all of that. And Paul applies the same principles to our life and the truth. He says, "Endure affliction." The word is rendered hardness in the Revised Version, if I remember correctly. Endure hardness. The life of a soldier, especially in the days of Paul, was a very hard life indeed. In the same epistle, 2 Timothy, chapter 1, verse 8, he says, "Endure the afflictions of the gospel." In other words, don't think that life in the truth is going to be a piece of cake. Don't think that everything is going to go along nicely and you won't have to trouble yourself or put yourself out to succeed in your walk to the kingdom. He says there are afflictions in life associated with the life in leading the gospel of Christ. And so that is very clearly and dramatically brought forth here. And so Joshua, having marched from Gilgal throughout the night, caught them unawares. You can imagine what happened. And you can imagine the reaction upon the enemy. And here's an interesting thing. Joshua came from the east. Compare that with Revelation 16 and verse 12. "The way of the kings who are out of a sun's rising." And with the light of the early morning sun, Joshua's army would have been poised in a high position, ready to attack. And the enemy here would have looked upward right into the brightness of the morning sun, and there was the belligerent, militant army of Joshua ready to pour down upon them and attack. And there is a beautiful sight of Christ and the saints in their manifestation against their political enemies in the earth at the time of the apocalypse of the rainbowed angel. And so in verse 10 it says, "And Yahweh discomfited them." The word is better rendered as in Roderick. Yahweh confused them. You can imagine the reaction upon this Gentile confederacy. They were stunned at the swiftness of Joshua's approach to the attack. No doubt the Amorites had planned a lightning campaign, which they hoped would succeed before Joshua could be advised of a predicament, and then probably working upon the principle that it would take him at least a couple of days to get there, they would have the matter all sewn up, everything well in hand, and be in possession of the vital strategic area before Joshua could get there. The very swiftness of Joshua's approach absolutely stunned these men. And so we read in verse 10 that they were slain with a great slaughter. And you know what that is telling us? You ought to look at those words very carefully. It means that the Elohim were at work on the field of battle. There were not only Israelites there pouring down upon those Gentiles with their swords aloft in their hands. The unseen angels of Yahweh were there upon that battlefield. The unseen Elohim were the evidence on behalf of the cause of Israel. And you never want to forget that. There are unseen angels of Yahweh present here at this moment of time. We know that the angel of Yahweh encampeth around them that fear him. So says the word of God. Let us remember those things. Let us remember that we live in the presence of the Elohim. That the angels are sent, as Paul says in Hebrews, to minister unto us for the good and the cause of Yahweh. And here they were on the field of battle, fighting the war for Israel. And the enemy was slain with a great slaughter. And it says that Israel chased them. Not simply pursued them, they chased them. And it means that the army of the Gentile confederacy fled in disarray before the onslaught of the Israelites. And then notice the meticulous care for detail once again. It says that they chased them by the way that goeth up to Beth-Horan. The name Beth-Horan signifies the house of caverns. But notice it says here, the way that goeth up to Beth-Horan. But in verse 11, it says they're going down to Beth-Horan. What have we got there? A contradiction? No, that is not so. In actual fact, there were two places, Beth-Horan. There was upper Beth-Horan on the mountains above, and there was lower Beth-Horan down below in the valley of Ajalon. And this place was 5 miles northwest of Gibeon. So here they were, very, very close. They firstly pursued the enemy to upper Beth-Horan, which rose to a rocky summit, and then it drops away sharply into the valley of Ajalon. And so they pursued them through that area. Here we've got Gibeon. Here we've got Beth-Horan up here, the upper and the lower. So that if we take our place from Jerusalem, here is Jerusalem here, here is Joshua's advance here from the east, and here is firstly Gibeon, and then upper Beth-Horan on the height to the very edge of the mountain, and then down below to Beth-Horan below. And then it says that he pursued him unto Azekah. Azekah was 16 miles south and slightly to the west of lower Beth-Horan, down the valley of Ajalon in the Shephelah. So virtually, they met them in battle here, and then turned and pursued them down in this southerly direction down here. They swung down here, following, of course, the army that was fleeing before them. So it says meticulously that they followed them to Azekah. Then it says that they followed them to Machedah. But Machedah was 3 miles north of Azekah. And if anything shows an army in utter confusion, this is it. You see, first of all, as the army tried to escape from Joshua, they turned sharply south, and the army pursued them. Then they swung around and went to the north again. And I believe that one of the things they would have been trying desperately to do would have been to enter some of the defense or fortress cities in that area, as we shall see in a few moments. Joshua especially makes mention of that. So there they were, and they pursued them. And they went in a going down to Beth-Horan. It's very interesting. You've got from upper Beth-Horan a 600-foot drop down a steep, rocky descent. And the mountain there falls away so steeply that steps have been cut into the rock to facilitate an ascent down that path. And it was always the route taken by invaders into the land, because strategically it was so vital. So we can see why it was important to both sides in the warfare. But then in verse 11 we read that Yahweh pursues the battle. It says, Yahweh cast down great stones from heaven. Here is literal divine intervention. And the language is that of a great storm. The skies blackened over. The clouds came sweeping in. Down came the hail and the stones and the tremendous outpouring of divine judgment. Just imagine the drama of even being present there at that time on that occasion. And in Isaiah chapter 30 and verse 30, you will read the same language of Yahweh's manifestation of judgment upon the Assyrian that is coming to invade the land in the latter days. The same language is used there in Isaiah 30 and verse 30. So here was absolute and complete proof, not only to Israel, but also to their enemies, that it was Yahweh's victory here in the land. It was not the victory of mere flesh. And it says specifically in verse 11 that hailstones destroyed more of the enemy than were slain by the sword of the Israelites. And so on they went. But at that crucial moment, Joshua could see that victory was not going to be complete, because night was going to come, the day was so short, and victory could be lost. Look at verse 12. Then spake Joshua to Yahweh, in the day when Yahweh delivered up the Amorites before the children of Israel, and he said in the sight of Israel, Sun, stand thou still upon Gibeon, and thou moon in the valley of Ajalon. And the sun stood still, and the moon stayed, until the people had avenged themselves upon their enemies. Now this unquestionably is one of the greatest days in the history of our nation. At that crucial moment when victory was almost complete, something of a great miraculous nature was required. He said, in the sight of Israel. And here, the black clouds of the storm and the thunder and the lightning are rolling away over the hills. The object of the storm has now been accomplished, and the awesome victory was there before them, but it was not complete. Something else was vital. Son, stand thou still upon Gibeon. The name Gibeon means the hill city, and I believe it stands there as a type for Rome. And the sun is a symbol for the Lord Jesus Christ. Moon in the valley of Ajalon. The name Ajalon signifies the place of gazelles. And gazelles were noted for their speed, their swiftness, and their great beauty. I believe an apt symbol for the ecclesia, for the multitudinous Christ. And of course the moon symbolizes the ecclesia also, reflecting the light of the sun. And notice particularly here that this was one of those days when both the sun and the moon were in the heavens at the same time. What a dramatic time of the day when the Son of Righteousness arises, and when the sun and the moon will remain aloft in the heavens until Yahweh's enemies are destroyed and until the kingdom is established in peace. In the day of Christ's manifestation, so will it be. And it's quite beautiful, you know, the way two of the prophets allude, especially to this day. Isaiah alludes to this great, awesome miracle in the language of his prophecy, when he says, Thy sun shall no more go down, neither shall thy moon withdraw itself. The day of Joshua in the valley of Ajalon, so shall it be in the establishment of the kingdom. And if you have a look at the words of Habakkuk in chapter 3 and verse 11 and 12, you'll find that he also alludes to that great day in the history of Israel. Speaking of the time when Christ and the saints will go forth in power to destroy the political and military powers of the Gentile nations, Habakkuk says, the sun and moon stood still in their habitation. At the light of thine arrows they went, and at the shining of thy glittering spear. Thou didst march through the land in indignation, thou didst thresh the heathen in anger. So we find that both Isaiah and Habakkuk, in their prophecies concerning the future manifestation of Christ in the earth, speak powerfully of that incident. And we need to remember that in this incident, Joshua asked for light that he might destroy God's enemies. There we can bring the type right back to ourselves. Joshua asked for light that he might destroy God's enemies. And we've got to do the same thing. The enemy we strive to destroy today is sin. And to accomplish that victory, we need light. We need the light of the Lord Jesus Christ and the light of the Word of God. And so the narrative says, the sun stood still and the moon stayed. Joshua's prayer brought an immediate, miraculous response from Yahweh. And that teaches us that our God listens attentively to the prayers of his faithful servants. And he is able to answer them immediately if the necessity should arise. He is able to accomplish anything on the behalf of his people. And so the sun stayed, we read, until the people had avenged themselves upon their enemies. And the light of the Word of God will eventually bring that result. Now notice that it says specifically that that situation was maintained about a whole day. About a whole day. It doesn't say exactly a whole day, but about. And it's rather interesting that an IBM computer has found that it was 23 hours and 20 minutes. I want to read you a very interesting article that was handed to me some months ago, taken from an American newspaper. You listen to this. And I'm quoting from the article. Did you know that the space program is busy proving that what has been called myth in the Bible is truth? Mr. Harold Hill, president of Curtis Engineering Co. in Baltimore, Maryland, and a consultant in the space program, related the following development. I think that one of the most amazing things that God has for us today happened recently to our astronauts and space scientists at Greenbelt, Maryland. They were checking the positions of the sun, moon, and planets out in space, where they would be 100 years and 1,000 years from now. We have to lay out the orbit in terms of the life of the satellite and where the planets will be, so the whole thing will not bog down. They ran the computer measurement back and forth over the centuries, and it came to a halt. The computer stopped, and it put up a red signal, which meant that there was something wrong either in the information fed into it or with the results as compared to the standards. They called in the service department to check it out, and they said, it's perfect. The IBM head of operations said, what's wrong? Well, we have found that there is a day missing in space in the elapsed time. They scratched their heads and pulled their hair. Very helpful, I'm sure. There was no answer. One religious fellow on the team said, you know, one time I was in Sunday school and they talked about the sun standing still. They didn't believe him, but they didn't have any other answer, so they said, show us. So he got out a Bible and went back to Joshua, where they found a pretty ridiculous statement for anybody who has common sense. There they found the Lord saying to Joshua, fear them not, I have delivered them into thy hand, and there shall not a man stand before them. Joshua was concerned because he was surrounded by the enemy, and if darkness fell, they would overpower him. So Joshua asked the Lord to make the sun stand still. That's right. The sun stood still and the moon stayed, and hasted not to go down about a whole day. The spacemen said, there is the missing day. Well, I checked the computer, going back into the time it was written, and found it was close, but not close enough. The elapsed time was 23 hours and 20 minutes, not a whole day. They read the Bible, and there it said, about a whole day. These little words in the Bible are important, the fellow says. But the scientists were still in trouble, because if you cannot account for 40 minutes, you'll be in trouble 10,000 years from now. Minutes had to be found because it multiplies many times over the orbit. Well, this religious fellow also remembered somewhere in the Bible where it said the sun went backwards. The spacemen told him he was out of his mind. But they got the Bible and read in 2 Kings 20 that Hezekiah, on his deathbed, was visited by the prophet Isaiah, who told him he was not going to die. Hezekiah didn't believe him and asked for a sign as proof. Isaiah asked, "Do you want the sun to go ahead 10 degrees? Hezekiah said, "It is nothing for the sun to go ahead 10 degrees, but let the shadow return backward 10 degrees. Isaiah spoke to the Lord, and the Lord brought the shadow 10 degrees backward. 10 degrees is exactly 40 minutes. And 23 hours and 20 minutes in Joshua, plus 40 minutes in 2 Kings 20, make the missing 24 hours that the space travellers had to log in the logbook as being the missing day in the universe." Now, you know, that is absolutely incredible. And over the centuries of time, who would have ever thought that one day before the time of the end, modern science, man with all his inventiveness, that will disregard the message of the Bible, that will treat this book as a book of mythology, that speaks in a very derogatory manner, not only of the God of Israel, but of the words that he has caused to be written, should themselves be the very man to establish, the very men to establish the truth and the authenticity of that to which we endeavour to give our reverence. So you see, there are the facts of the matter as they apply in history, in the book of Joshua, and there are the facts as they are today, supported by the discoveries of men of science, so-called. And so here was this great event as it occurred here. And we read that this great victory came to Israel. And we read in the 14th verse, "There was no day like that, before it or after it." And I want to impress on you the fact that that is the only place in the scriptures where that phrase is used of an incident of history. The only place where you'll find that language in the Bible, that in relation to an incident of history. "But Yahweh hearkened unto the voice of man," and notice these words, some of the most thrilling words anywhere in the Bible, "for Yahweh fought for Israel." And we've got to remember that in these days as never before. Yahweh fought for Israel. And don't we read in Romans 8 verse 31, that if God be for us, who can be against us? What does it matter what forces of power are wielded against the Israel of God? What does it matter? If God be for us, who can be against us? And how does the Lord say in Luke chapter 18, verse 7 and 8, that the Lord will avenge his people speedily when the time comes that it should be so, such as we have found here? Here are words to stir and encourage every one of us. "For Yahweh fought for Israel." And we need to remember, brethren and sisters, that he fights for the Israel of God today. We don't see manifestations such as Israel witnessed in the days of Joshua. But Yahweh's presence is among us, surely. Yahweh's angels administer unto us, surely. Yahweh is today bringing the nations into the very situation that we find here in the book of Joshua, that they might be defeated and humbled before him, that their power might be stripped away, that they might see, in the words of Psalm 2, that they either humble themselves before the mighty Son of God or be destroyed by the fire of his presence. These, I believe, are words to thrill us today if we are willing to be thrilled. Because we live in the day when the latter-day Joshua, the antitype of Joshua, is soon to descend from the heavens with a shout and to take up his throne and reign upon the earth. And we talk about this. But does it live in our hearts by faith? Are we really motivated by those wonderful principles concerning the future to guide us through the dark and difficult times of today? It's time we gave more thought to things of this nature, brethren and sisters. And so the battle was pursued, but the five kings, we read in verse 16, fled and hid themselves in a cave at Machedah. The Septuagint renders it, "the cave at Machedah." And we believe it was a special cave and very, very well known. Known to the Canaanites, but of course not to the Israelites. So they turned back in an orderly direction. They came to Machedah, but they weren't going to escape. So Joshua gave some very sound advice. Verse 18 and verse 19. He says, "Look, roll some big stones in the mouth so they can't get away, keep a couple of men there to keep guard of the thing. Stay ye not, he says to the soldiers, stay ye not, but pursue after your enemy. Literally, the Hebrew is, stand not still. Don't stand around. And it's a reminder that life in the truth is a continual warfare against sin. It is a continual warfare on the behalf of the cause of Yahweh. There must be no diversion to put us off the course. That's what Joshua is saying. So he says, pursue after them. And notice at the end of verse 19, don't let them enter into their cities. The reason being that many of these cities were not simply cities, but they were fortresses. Joshua said, you've got to get them before they can get into what he calls in verse 20, the fenced cities. Or as Rotherham translates it, the fortified cities. And so eventually the battle was pursued. And in verse 21 we read, and all the people returned to the camp to Joshua at Makkedah in peace. None moved his tongue against any of the children of Israel. So they returned, and how beautiful is this language. Having disposed of the enemy, we read that all the people returned in peace. They are significant words in their symbolic teaching. They are telling us that lasting peace will only come to the earth when the wicked are restrained and when righteousness prevails. That's the lesson of that verse, and that's when we have peace. Isaiah 57 verse 20 and 21 says there's no peace to the wicked. But Isaiah 32 verse 16 and 17 says that peace will prevail upon the earth when princes who rule by righteous judgment will be established to govern the nations and the kingdoms of the world. So they returned in peace. And the nations of the vicinity were absolutely silent. None moved his tongue against any of the children of Israel. And so then, when the victory had been gained, when the battle had been accomplished up to that point, Joshua then says in verse 22, open the mouth of the cave and bring out those five kings unto me out of the cave. They were going to be arraigned for judgment. And this is typical of the judgment to come upon the kings and the nobles of the Gentiles at the hands of the greater Joshua and his sons. These are words that typify that which we see in Psalm 149, verses 8 to 9. Bring out the king. And what does Psalm 149 say? It says that the saints shall take the nobles and the kings of the Gentiles and put them in fetters of iron and chains. Here is a point that is typical of that which is written in that 149th Psalm. And again in verse 23, we find that the king of Jerusalem is mentioned first. Undoubtedly, the leader of this confederacy. Here is the type of the latter-day Babylon of Revelation 17 and 18, who claims to be the true spiritual Jerusalem, as this man did, but is in fact Antichrist. And then I want you to give careful consideration to one of the greatest highlights in the whole book of Joshua, in the 24th verse. Here is one of the great and thrilling highlights of the whole book. And it came to pass, when they brought out those kings under Joshua, that Joshua called for all the men of Israel, and said unto the captains of the men of war which went with him, come near, put your feet upon the necks of these kings. And they came near, and put their feet upon the necks of them. Now this is a ceremony that took place. It was a sign of victory. But you see what has actually happened. Bring them forth, lay them down on the dirt, and put your feet on their necks, said Joshua. These representatives of the nation. In other words, the enemy had now become their footstool. Psalm 110 and verse 1. 1 Corinthians chapter 15 and verse 25 has this thought to add to Psalm 110. For he must reign till he hath put all enemies under his feet. And although we quote from 1 Corinthians 15 verse 25, Paul, in his turn, is quoting from Psalm 8. And there can be no doubt that we have originating both from Psalm 110 and Psalm 8 an echo of Genesis 3 verse 15. Satan was to be bruised under the heel of the Son of Man. And it's rather interesting the way in which we find the language of the scripture unfolding that to us even further. Notice the wording of Psalm 18 and verse 40. Here is the David as a type of Christ making this statement to God. Thou hast also given me the necks of mine enemies, that I might destroy them that hate me. There's the same language. And one of the most interesting ones you will find, we might say perhaps of all places, we don't really mean that in a literal sense, but we wouldn't expect to find that language, in Romans chapter 16 and verse 20. As we draw these various scriptures to a head, draw them to a head as we see them centered upon that chapter in Joshua, and we find Paul applying all those lessons in his encouragement to the brethren at Rome. Because in Romans 16 and verse 20, he encourages them with these words. And the God of peace, that's what's going to come to the people of God. Remember, they came back to Machadah in peace. The warfare was accomplished. Paul says, and the God of peace shall bruise the Satan, that should read from the Greek text, the God of peace shall bruise the Satan under your feet shortly. Can you see the glorious type in Joshua chapter 10 and verse 24? We have first of all the type of the perfected Israel sharing the victory in their great conquest over sin before they pass into the kingdom. And notice here a beautiful point. According to the traditions of the time, it would have been Joshua who would have done that. But Joshua doesn't do it. He steps back in humility, actually. And he brings out the captains and he says, look, I want you to do this before all Israel. In other words, Joshua gave them the victory, which is exactly what's going to happen with Christ and us. Joshua is going to give us the victory. It's absolutely magnificent. And you've got it all there in Joshua 10, verse 24. The victory of the saints of Christ over sin. Their final and complete conquest at the judgment seat of Christ. But then, as we've seen from the other scriptures, Psalm 18 and verse 40, there is a further enactment. Because once they have gained the victory over sin for themselves personally, through that which Christ will do for them, the greater Joshua, they must then go forth against the nations of the earth to strip them of their power and to subject them to the same humility before Christ that they themselves have had to learn. And you want to remember this, brethren and sisters. We don't want to get any wonderful ideas about what we're going to do to the nations in the kingdom age until we appreciate the principle that everything that we've got to teach the nations in the kingdom age, we've got to learn to do now. We've got to learn to do now. And then, and only then, will we be qualified to act for Christ on that behalf in the kingdom age. So you see, the kings and the nobles of the Gentiles are going to have to experience the same thing. And the force of sin is going to have to be conquered, not only in the individual saints, but throughout the earth, as it is manifested politically and ecclesiastically. And so there is a way in which this great drama was unfolded before the Israelites. And at that moment of time, Joshua gave an exhortation, a most appropriate moment. And you find that he does that at quite remarkable places in the history of things. You'll find Joshua gets up and says a few words. And they're always very much to the point, and they are always words of exhortation. Verse 25 says, and Joshua said unto them, fear not, nor be dismayed. Be strong and of a good courage, for thus shall Yahweh do to all your enemies against whom ye fight. And Joshua, now a man rich in faith, one who has learned by the experiences of life, and the application of the principles of the Word of God to all his actions in life, now encourages his own brethren with the very words that Yahweh had addressed to him in chapter 1 at the time when he took up his warfare of faith on behalf of Yahweh and the people of God. And so the battle is now renewed with renewed vigor. They have undergone the remarkable ceremony that we have seen in verse 24. And in verse 26 it says, and afterward Joshua smote them and slew them, and hanged them on 5 trees, and they were hanging upon the trees until the evening. Now that is what happened there before they went on to pursue the battle against the remaining nations of the south. They took them, and they smote them, and they slew them. Now couldn't they have just given them a good talking to and let them go? The answer is no. Because there can be no compromise in the warfare against sin. This verse contains a mighty message. There can be no compromise in the warfare against sin. Because it is a fight to the death. And neither party will yield until victory is gained by one or the other. That's the message of verse 26. That's the message of it. And so he hanged them on 5 trees after they'd been slain. A putting to death of the flesh. A type of the crucifixion of the flesh. And then in verse 27, it came to pass at the time of the going down of the sun, in strict requirements of the law, that Joshua commanded, and they took them down off the trees, cast them into the cave wherein they had been hid, and laid great stones in the cave's mouth, which remain until this very day. And that day Joshua took Machedah, and smote it with the edge of the sword, and the king thereof, he utterly destroyed them, and all the souls that were therein, and he let none remain, and he did to the king of Machedah as he did unto the king of Jericho. Then Joshua passed from Machedah, and all Israel with him, unto Libnah, and fought against Libnah. From there we go on down through, and find that he went from Libnah to Lachish. So now, having accomplished the first initial victory, having destroyed the Confederate kings, they now with renewed vigor push south that they might take these places down here. And we find that the place names that we're reading there in those verses of Joshua take them down through here to the Shephelah, picking off one by one these major cities. Here is Machedah. From Machedah, they swung west and over here to Libnah. They come from Libnah straight down to Lachish. From there they turned east, and went straight across to Hebron. And if you study that with a little bit of time, you'll find that Joshua's movements were incredible. And the Gentiles never knew where he was going to strike next. First to the south, then to the west, then back to the east, then up into the hills, then down into the Shephelah again. And they were so reeling under the onslaught of this warfare that they never knew where to expect him to attack next. And so away he went with a pursuit of that warfare. And he went, notice it says in verse 28, verse 29, all Israel with him. That is the army of Israel. And the battle was gaining momentum. And Joshua continued to press the conquest, giving neither the enemy nor his own troops any rest whatsoever. Giving the kingdoms of the south no opportunity to regroup their forces and recover their defenses. Absolutely incredible strategy. But what about Joshua's army? Were they working a 40-hour week? Oh, they were tired men. They must have been tired. Can you imagine one of them going up to Joshua and saying, look, under the new award, you know, look, this is an absolutely magnificent lesson, if only we'll open our eyes to see it. Here is the warfare of faith. You see, as long as they kept going, they got the victory. As long as they fought on in faith, Yahweh was with them, and they went from victory to victory to victory. There was no respite whatsoever. And so down they went through the nations, and they took them, and they smote them. And finally they came down to Lachish, as we saw just a few moments ago. A very heavily fortified city, because it was the main route down into the Nile Valley. A very important place. And then in verse 33, you read of a very odd thing. You read in verse 33 of a fellow who didn't have enough sense to stay home. Here we find Joshua way down in this area here. And we read of this fellow from up here, Giza. Horam, king of Giza. And you know what he did? Instead of staying home and reading his newspaper more carefully, he gets his army together and sends words down here and says, don't worry, fellows, we're coming to help. Bang! Pow! He didn't know what hit him. Horam, king of Giza. Very well known. If ever there was a silly old Giza, that was him. But you know, even in that, there's a lesson. Just look at the stupidity of that man. And you know, we can get a bit of a joke out of that as we see the humanity of it in the book. But we want to think again as well. We do that sort of thing. We all do that. Rush in. We do stupid, foolhardy things. Instead of firstly weighing up the consequences of what our action might bring. We might say something, we might do something, we might say, right, I'm going to do such and such, and we do it, and oh, goodness me, what happens? You see, the man was just plain foolhardy. He didn't know when to be sensible and when not to be. So the thing is that we take lessons from all of these kings and all of these men. Here was the foolhardiness of the flesh, the thoughtless way in which any one of us can do things that are really not very sensible and which eventually bring a lot of trouble to ourselves and all those who are with us. And so the final comments in the chapter come to us as we read in verse 40 and 41, "So Joshua smote all the country of the hills and of the south and of the vale and of the springs and all their kings. He left none remaining, but utterly destroyed all that breathed." Another reference to Deuteronomy 7. "Utterly destroyed all that breathed, as Yahweh Elohim of Israel commanded. And Joshua smote them from Kadesh Barnea." That's even off our map. He's gone so far south. "From Kadesh Barnea even unto Gaza." Now notice how meticulous the narrative is. Unto Gaza. Joshua never took Gaza. He never took Gaza at all. And it mentions there Goshen, which was in the mountains southwest of Hebron, and unto Gibeon, that means all the way back again. And all these kings and their land did Joshua take at one time, because Yahweh Elohim of Israel fought for Israel. And Joshua returned, and all Israel with him, unto the camp of Gilgal. They returned victorious. Why? Because Yahweh fought for Israel. And the fact is that Yahweh blessed their faith. He blessed their courage. He blessed their determination. He blessed their dedication. He blessed their single-minded effort. All of the qualities that are required for the warfare against sin. But as we see that it was because Yahweh gave them the victory, we also see very dramatically and clearly that divine help does not exclude human effort. And had the Israelites not pressed forward to the battle, then the hailstones would not have fallen, the victory would not have happened, and the Gentile confederacy would not have fled before them. So we are able to see from that glorious chapter that in one swift, devastating campaign, the whole of southern Palestine was delivered into the hands of Joshua and his triumphant army. And one of the Gentiles arrayed against them? Psalm 33 verse 10 answers that. Yahweh brought the counsel of the heathen to naught. And he will do that today. And he will do it in the future. And here was a battle that changed the entire course of human history. A battle which we should appreciate as one of the great and remarkable incidents in the history of our nation. When Israel were on the road of warfare, did Israel lose any of their soldiers? Well, the answer is really that, so far as I'm aware anyway, we don't know. We read of the losses concerning Ai when 36 men died through lack of faith. We don't read of further death subsequent to that time in the general narrative of the conquest of the land. That is not to say that men did not die, but let's simply consider the question in this way. The answer, I would say, is what a wonderful way to die. Because let's face it, does it really matter? You see, we are looking here at men who are fighting for Yahweh in faith. They are obedient, they do what they're told, they are fearless in the way they attack the strongholds of the enemy. The picture that we will see tomorrow morning, God willing, is even more dramatic than chapter 10, if that was possible. But you see, here we've got men of faith. You see, these men are very similar to men of God in any age. And if they are fighting the warfare of faith, if they are obeying the requirements of Yahweh, if they are rich in their desire to serve him in the spirit of holiness, As we are led to believe these men were, under the leadership of Joshua, hence their victories, what does it matter when they die? The thing is, they will gain the kingdom of God. And after all, surely, that is the important issue at stake. Was that a question, or were you... Great, question from Keith. Do the men of Gibeon type Israel after the flesh today? Well, it is a rather interesting thought, and I think that if we were thought, we'd find that the cap would fit. And it's probably a very good thought. Remember that Israel today are virtually cut off from the Lord Jesus Christ because of the blindness of their heart. They believe that through the doctrine of Judaism, through the keeping of law, which they don't even attempt to keep anyway, that they can have hope. And so perhaps in a certain sense, the Gibeonites and their approach to the things of God could typify the aspect of Israel after the flesh today. We'll find no objection to that on the surface of it anyway. Is Zechariah 14:3 an antitype of what we've been studying this morning in Joshua 10, right? The answer is clearly and emphatically yes. Because here we have the day when, in chapter 14, verse 1, that we know so well, the day of Yahweh cometh, and thy spoil shall be divided in the midst of thee, for I will gather all nations against Jerusalem to battle. Now notice, the very opening words of Zechariah 14 are exactly to the point as we have it in Joshua 10. It was not Israel's day, it was not the Gentiles' day, it was Yahweh's day. And the chapter 10 of Joshua virtually begins and ends upon the note that it would be Yahweh's victory. So when the Gentile hordes in the antitype of chapter 10 are drawn down into this land to try and take possession of it for themselves, it will be the day of Yahweh. That means virtually that he's going to come out on top. That's what the language means. And the language of verse 3 stresses the point when we read, then shall Yahweh go forth and fight against those nations as when he fought in the day of battle. And one of those days was the day of which we have read this morning in Joshua chapter 10. Well, I don't know. The article to which we referred in an American paper, that it was later denied. Well, if there's anybody here who knows something about that, they can perhaps have a chat with me afterwards. I'd be really interested to know. But actually, a brother in Perth produced a copy of this for me, which I read, and naturally enough, I found it very impressive. But I have not heard anything since then that are contrary to it. Rather interesting. Actually, there are some suggestions. The question is, oh, anyone want to hear the question, Badge, you're so close to the microphone. The question is a rather interesting one, but we need to remember that they've got a very great military and tactical advantage here. It's an ideal place for an encampment. Now, there are some suggestions, and I think you'll read this even in some Christadelphian literature, that there was another place called Gilgal, further up here in the north of the land, not that far from Shechem, up here. And we agree that that is right. And it is sometimes suggested that where we read in chapter 9 that Joshua led his people back to Gilgal, that he led them to this Gilgal up here. Now, I don't believe that that is so, by virtue of the fact that the language of Joshua makes no indication that they ever shifted their main camp during these campaigns. I feel that Joshua is such a meticulous historian. He is so meticulous, even in the choice of a small word, that had it been that they had shifted their entire camp from one Gilgal to another, there would be a record of it in the book of Joshua, and there is no such record. Moreover, there is no reason why they should shift. Particularly when you consider the position here, they are safe from the nations of the east, who were of course by this time recovering from the earlier warfare against Sihon and Og. They are safe from there, unless these fellows had someone who could open the Jordan up for them, which would be a little difficult, without the right connections. Therefore, they had an absolutely safe defence behind them. They were set in a plain. They had completely slaughtered all opposition in an area around them here.
So it was the ideal place to establish a bridgehead and to establish themselves as in a strategic position and until they had completed the conquest of the south of the land. Now you will notice in that 10th chapter this morning, in further answer to Sandra's question, that at one stage there in chapter 10, it does say that they returned to the camp at Makeda, which was here. But I believe that if you consider the narrative carefully, it will indicate that this was a camp here for the fighting men. They established a camp here while they continued to pursue the battle in the southern part of the land. So I would suggest that the main camp remained for some time here at Gilgal, and that in various other parts throughout the land, they established temporary headquarters for the army to operate from, such as in the case of Makeda.
Even in this century, it's still a very important place,
thinking
for bridges,
right
where the
Albury
Bridge is,
and,
yes,
in which we stand.